Let's give a warm welcome to our speaker, Paul Lee.
I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, member of the Express Group. My name is Paul Lee. Let me tell you something. It's very hot in here tonight, but I'm sure a lot of you have been in a lot hotter places. So, like, if you can't deal with it, leave now, because we got about 40 minutes, and I'm going to roll, because I am feeling the deal tonight. All right? We're going to be right on rocking tonight, okay? I mean, I got some stuff happening in my life here tonight. I'm looking right in front of part of it. And I saw Maureen somewhere. And Tracy, what are you, the secretary in every fellowship of every program I go to? Everywhere I go, she does the secretary report. N-A, G-A, O-A. She's there. Oh, great, very sick ticket. I like that. Right where you belong, honey. You keep coming back. We got a program for you, too. Hey, Don, I work alone. Don, you don't want that head, bro. Easy. Anyway, if you're new or you're coming back, welcome home. You're off the hook.
Yeah.
And that's what was told to me a very long time ago, right when I walked into these rooms, and it's 100% true. So please, no matter what, I don't care what's going on in your life, if romance, finance, house foreclosures, deaths, it doesn't matter. If you pick up, after you're here, it's going to get worse. How do I know that? Because I've been to so more funerals than I could possibly count. I visited people doing life in prison after they were here. Once you're here, you don't have to go any lower. That's all I'm going to tell you. What is that, one of those women who's had a tragic recovery? Many of my women do go lower, but that's really not neither here nor there. Oh, my God. How could you possibly say that? Oh, my God, Betty Friedan, women's lib. Well, please, then, just let's calm down. Well, easy, easy. Come on, we got people from other countries here. I mean, come on now. Please, you got Atlanta in the back. Anyway, listen, there's 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, 200 words. That's the total of the 12 steps. Those 200 words can change your life. It says it in everything, and they read it, and we say it. If you want what we have, you do what we do. And you're guaranteed to get it. The converse of that, if you don't want what we have, and you don't do what we do, you're guaranteed not to get it. That's just the way it works. It's not like any rocket science in here. You know, I was just listening to this tape of Bill Wilson, like from 50 or 60 years ago. This guy was amazing. You know, if he was the co-founder of AA, if he was born today, he would have been in charge of making the subprime crisis. He was a money, he was like a promoter. He was doing back-end stuff and everything else. But by the grace of God, God worked through him to put this book together. Somehow, some way. This power is so amazing, but the power is really very important unless you acknowledge you're an alcoholic or an addict. For me, I'm not even going to say alcoholic or an addict. The bottom line, if you are here, and you are a pure alcoholic, if you use a chemical, you're going to become purely a drug addict very quickly. How do I know that? Because I've watched it happen. So all I'm saying, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of total abstinence. We don't pick up one chemical for one day. And we have 12 steps. So the first half of the first step, we went over this last week. We'll just do a two-minute recap. The first half of the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That's a truth. And a truth will never change. I was powerless the day I got here. I'm going to be powerless till the day I die. The second half of the first step is a fact. Hey, come on, grab a seat. Not her, I mean a seat. The second half of the first step, that's a fact that our lives had become unmanageable. And when we get here, our lives are very unmanageable. That fact can and does change, because in the second step, we begin to find a manager. That's the whole purpose of these 12 steps, of the whole program. If you read this book, it says the purpose of this book is not to show you how not to drink. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say the purpose of this book is to show you how to find a house. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say the purpose of this book is to show you how to find a wife. It doesn't say that. It says the purpose of this book is to show the reader how to come to find a power greater than themselves that can solve their problem. Any power greater than you that can solve your problem. Not problems, because you only have one problem, and that's chemicals. And if you pick up, then you don't need to worry about any of the powers because you'll be gone. And if you stay here, that power will help you accept and enjoy whatever comes down the path. You know, just because we come into Alcoholics Anonymous does not mean we come in, we put down the chemicals, and we skip up the 12 golden steps of life. That's not what happens. Trust me, anybody that's been here for any period of time will tell you, pain, more pain, and more pain is how we grow. I don't understand that. I really don't. And there's great stuff I don't understand. I don't understand a lot of stuff in here, but I trust it because of the desperation I had when I got here. And if you have that gift of desperation, G-O-D, and you're here tonight with us, and you do a few simple things, I promise you, your life will get better. That's all I'm going to promise you. It's a guarantee. Jimmy, you're like, what are you doing here? Come on. You're like, you got 6 days or ADD? I mean, come on, slow down. You're very come on. We shoot people in New York. Yeah. Anyway, the five real simple things you need to do just to guarantee being sober is you get up in the morning and just ask for help. I don't care whether you believe in anything. It doesn't matter. Because I'm sure looking at this room, most people have been in places where they've said stupid things at different times. You're being whacked. And whatever. I mean, that's just what we do. So just make believe. Nobody's there. Nobody's listening. And just say a stupid thing. Help me stay clean and sober today. Just to the wall, okay? And then get a sponsor. And if you don't have a sponsor, you can't do this. I don't think you can. You need somebody to share with, someone who's been down the road, somebody that is not going to come from a judgment place, because we're all the same. You know, I've been doing this for a while, but believe me, I am one drink or one drug away from a major disaster. So why do I come here? To prevent going to that one drink or one drug? And also because I love it. And because I've been removed, that obsession has been removed. That mental obsession, the psychosis that I was living in for so many years of my life has been taken. So I know that I couldn't do that. And I know that my story, you know, my sponsor, one of my sponsors, Fred T., God rest his soul, he would always say, has anyone told you they loved you yet today? If not, let me be the first. That's why he started every conversation. In a meeting when he shared, when he called, I mean, the whole deal, it was like, he was the love doctor. I had another sponsor who's still alive. I love him. He's a good friend of mine. But Joe, who many people here know, I asked Joe to be my sponsor at my first meeting because he had scars on his face. He got sober in Trenton State Prison. And I figured I was going to listen to him because I was afraid. You know, I mean, I was tired of like soft soaping people my whole life. And so I figured if Joe told me something, I would listen. Well, Joe's my sponsor. He gives me the instructions or whatever. And about 90 days into my sobriety, or 90 days, sobriety is a bad word, 90 days without drinking or drugging, I was living with my third or fourth relationship in 1980. Joe, at this point in time, called me up and he says, Paul, would you come up to the house? I want to talk to you. I went up to his house in Pompano. And he was in the air conditioning repair business. I knocked on the door. And he said, oh, good, come out to the truck for a minute. And he went out to his truck. And he reached under the seat of his truck. And he pulled out a .357 Magnum. And he put it to my head. And he said, if you're not out of that house by the morning, I'm going to blow your effing brains out. And he put the gun away. Now, I have read this book. Read it cover to cover, backwards and front. I've listened to the tapes and everything else. Nowhere does it say sponsor pulls piece on pigeon. However, I moved out. He got my attention. I got to this program because I was really finished drinking and drugging in 1969, but somehow I wasn't directed here till 1980. So those 11 years when I realized that I'd been blessed to not have to go out after I got here, because I spent 11 years in degradation, desperation, humiliation, insane from 1969 to 1980. The last time drinking and using was fun for me was 1969. That was the last time that I had a party. As a matter of fact, the way I look at it really is the Beatles came to Shea Stadium in 1965. I'm from Queens, and we rushed the fences, and I woke up 15 years later. I mean, that's what happened. It was a 15-year disappearing act. The first 4 years were cute. You know, a couple of social arrests, everything was free, sex, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, that was the time. You know, if you're not from the 60s, you can only imagine, you know, go rent a movie like Woodstock. I may be in it. But the bottom line is that, I mean, it was like sick times. I mean, it was really, it's so, I mean, that's the reason, in my opinion, the country is in the shape we're in today, is because of what happened during the 60s. But that's an issue for another topic and another meeting, another arena. But the reality is, we were a very confused lot back then. And so I spent from 1969, after I was finished having fun, and I wanted a detox, I was finished. And everything kept progressing. The arrests kept progressing. The drugs kept progressing. The amount of intake kept progressing. And for those 11 years on the streets of New York, I went to many mental hospitals, or like they say, houses for the very, very nervous. That's what my friend Gasper said. I started off in the nice ones, Hillside General Hospital, where you let your families visit you and watch you make leather belts on the weekend. And then they medicated me, and I was a paranoid, schizophrenic, manic, depressive, and then they put me on these medications, and I started shaking, and then I became suicidal. I mean, that whole year of my life, from 1976 to 1977, I spent in a depreciating level of New York State's finest mental hospital. Today, by the way, they call them treatment centers, so don't be laughing at me. Today, they call them treatment centers. They charge you $30,000. They still, it's the same thing. But I ended up in one that was a far cry from a treatment center. It's the place on the Grand Central Parkway when you're going to Long Island and you're like me or like Maureen, who was also there. They point to the place, your parents, and they say, if you don't straighten up, you're going to end up there. And that's called Creedmoor State Hospital. Not a nice place. I mean, it really, I don't know if this is an indication. Whenever anyone asks me, did you have shock treatments? Well, I remember being in the room. I remember getting ready, but then I don't remember anything. So the odds are that there is a little bit of better living through chemistry going on in this frame. In 1976, I committed suicide. Not jokingly, but I took a massive overdose, and I was in a coma for 6.5 days, Long Island Jewish Hospital. And on the third day of that coma, they called my wife and my parents to the consultation room, and they said, look, just accept right now that he's gone, so it'll make it easier, because if he happens to live, he's going to be a vegetable. Some people think that diagnosis was correct. However, You know, my parents kept coming and my wife kept coming. And they told me this afterwards. They would talk to me and hold my hand. And I woke up 3.5 days later. And I was really pissed off when I saw this doctor in front of me. Because I really wanted out. It wasn't a cry for help, man. I was done. Stop the world. I want to get out. And they put me in another one of these specialized... they were 90-day programs back then. And this was in a private place in Long Island Jewish Hospital. And they changed my diagnosis. They made me from a paranoid schizophrenic to a manic depressive. That was the first day I graduated in my whole life. Wow. I felt of worth, man. I wanted to live again. You know, I became president of the unit. I mean, how cool was that? You knew I was back on my game. I was walking around, president. Anyway, that wasn't the end. That was a year of that psychosis. I got out of there in February of 1977, and in March of 1977, I was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, ripping and roaring. So I'm not trying to scare you. You can't scare me. You can't scare this disease. This abnormal obsession can't be scared by words. When you hit the wall, and each one of our walls is different, God willing, you hit the wall before they plant you. God willing, you hit the wall before you plant someone else. God willing, right here, you've hit the wall. And now, mad, glad, or sad, you're going to go to meetings, you're going to get a sponsor, you're going to put these 12 steps in your life, and you're going to learn how you can get one of the promises, which is to be happy, joyous, and free. Because it says it in this book. Page 133. For after all, God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Now, if you're coming to believe, which we're going to do here tonight, we're going to at least broach that topic, well, then why wouldn't you want to, like, do what he wants? Happy, joyous, and free, jails, institutions of death. Happy, joyous, and free, jails, institutions of death. Most alcoholics said, give me a minute, let me think about it. I mean, come on, what, are you kidding me? You know, this divine providence that has happened, I don't really... You are so lucky that you are the only person in this room that would get a pass on that. No, no, it's Mason from Queens. He's very dysfunctional. Well, he's got so many issues. How could I yell him about his phone ringing? Mason's got issues that haven't even been uncovered yet in any of those programs, trust me. Anyway. See, that's what happens is I lose my thing. Okay, good. Right, it takes us a while to think. Actually, when I got here, they said to me that you could be happy, Jewish, and free. You really took that to another level. Which we'll get to in a minute. Anyway. So, you know, there was really very few people here in 1980. When I got here, I read an article, I go to a meeting, and I leave the meeting. What am I doing? It actually was an NA meeting. It was one NA meeting. And this guy who took me to the first meeting and refused to take me home because I was so obnoxious on the ride down. I mean, imagine that. A real active 12-step member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober 3.5 years, picks me up, spends 20 minutes in the car with me, and says, I cannot take him home. So, you know, Maureen and Jim took me home and dropped me off. And 2 days later, I called back Curtis. And I said, he evidently didn't remember how bad the trip was. And I said, would you take me to a meeting? He took me to a meeting. This was the first piece. Looking back now, there was many pieces long before I got here. And there's been certainly many pieces since then. But looking back, I can look at this as like one of those defining moments, one of those aha moments that we all have. But this was my, you know, major, or the major one. I walk into this room, the St. Francis Mission in Fort Lauderdale. It was on 6th Street by the courthouse. And I walk in, it's a little dank room, there's six or seven people there, and they certainly didn't look very attractive, like I would want anything they had, even in my worst day. And so I went to Curtis, I said, sorry to bother you, thanks, but no thanks. If I ever need you, I'll give you a call. Here's what happened. At or about 8:27 p.m. on February 12, 1980, as I'm walking out of the St. Francis Mission in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in walks a guy from my block in Queens, New York City. Someone that I drank and drugged with, didn't know where he was, didn't know where I was. At the exact minute I'm leaving, he's walking in. I didn't do backflips and say, oh, wow, Mark, thank God you're here. I know I'm good now. But somehow we ended up hugging, and I ended up back in the room. And I sat down, and I picked up a cup of coffee, and they had a desk in the front of the room, and he was at the front of the desk. He had been asked to speak at that meeting 3 weeks before that night. Now, I didn't need to listen to his story because I lived it with him. His arrests were in the paper just like mine. As a matter of fact, his were even better because in the 60s, when they were doing these drug sweeps in Queens, they did one when we were all in high school and obviously sleeping in our parents' house. And his picture was on the front page of the Daily News because back then people with weird hair, they slept with rollers in their hair, curlers. So it said on the front page of the Daily News, Mark Friedman, curlers in his hair, you know, taken out of Pearl's house. So obviously the next year or so in Bayside High School wasn't that serene for Mark. He had to learn how to get real fisty real quickly. And the reality is, he was speaking that night. I was listening. I didn't need to listen to his story. I started paying attention when he said, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or a drug for 6 months. Got my attention. Him, just like me, couldn't go 6 weeks. Couldn't go 6 days. You know, the only time I refused a drink or a drug is if I misunderstood the question. I wasn't one of these people that said, oh, thanks, I've had enough. I mean, my had enough mode was unconscious. That was it. That was the only time I have had enough. So I picked up that white chip that night. By the grace of God, you people, some miracle, magical thing that was cast over me, by the grace of this power, whatever you choose to call it, my life has not had to be under the influence since that day. Has it been all incredible? Absolutely not. There's been deaths, divorces, bankruptcies, federal indictments, all in my sobriety. Okay, I mean, there's one thing I've learned in my sobriety, and I'm going to put this out, it really had nothing to do with tonight. But, you know, we all come here, we're very judgmental. It's just part of our nature. It's part of our nature. In the Jewish religion, they have something that's called Lashon Hara. It's like talking evil of someone else, slander, gossip. And in the Torah, it says that Lashon Hara is more severe an offense than idolatry, adultery, and murder combined. I didn't write that. That's what it says. And we're all guilty of it, and it's all something that we want to do. But here's the reason it's so severe. Because if I'm talking bad about someone, I'm hurting myself by demeaning myself to need to feel better by talking about someone else. I'm hurting the person I'm making listen to this diatribe about someone else. I'm dragging them down to my level. And then, of course, I'm hurting the person I'm speaking of. So you know what? My sponsor always said, if you want to talk about someone, talk about God. Because he doesn't take offense. Because any time I'm talking about someone else, it's generally going to be to make me feel better. So I used to watch Ray all the time when the conversation would invariably go, did you hear what happened? He would turn his hearing aid off. I swear to God, he just refused to participate. And that's what I try to do today. I just won't jump in. I don't need to feel better that way. I have a God that loves me. I love him. We love each other. I love people. Baba Bai has given me the greatest gift in the world. He's taken away this mania for alcohol and drugs. So how can I think he can't do anything else? And that's where it began for me. When I realized that I woke up on my second or third day, and not only had I not gotten high, I hadn't thought of gotten high. That never happened, ever. Something was happening here. something dramatic was happening here. And the drama has continued. You know, I got sober, and my dad, God rest his soul, who was my main champion my whole life, and he had these great plans in retirement and everything else, and he developed terminal cancer 3 months before I got sober. And he was in New York, and I was flying up and back. By this time, I was on government disability insurance because the United States government, Ronald Reagan, had determined that I was such a menace mentally, a mental menace, or as it says in the book, a mental defective. I was such a mental defective, he felt it a better idea for the United States government to send me these massive checks every month so that I wouldn't even look for a job. He felt it was better. They probably did a cost analysis in the White House. Well, we send him this cash and we don't hear his name that often. And they just kept sending it. So Tony Cash's disability check. So I would fly up and back, and finally I had 6 months sober, and actually Yisrael was probably at this meeting. I don't remember. By the way, can I blow your cover here? Good. Well, I'll tell that story in a minute. But anyway, Yisrael and I got sober together in the Express Group in the same week in 1980. Now, what happened is the one time that I really was seriously going to drink and use since I've been sober was August 28th, 1980. I had 6 months. I had just come back from New York. My dad was dying. It was terrible to see. My ex-wife, I was having problems with her, with my daughter who was 4 or 5 years old. And just like things, you know, the six-month pink cloud was wearing off and life was showing up. And I just said, screw it, I'm going to get loaded. I had some money. I said, so I'm just going to go out and I'll find the gutter rats down here in Florida, because I never got high down here. Now, it was the summertime in August, so it gets late. I mean, it gets dark later. So I'm driving around like different unhealthy neighborhoods where I figured I could find my people. And my people don't come out till it's dark. So, as I did. So it's August 28, 1980, but then I remembered something. It was a Thursday night. I said, wait a second, there's a beginner's meeting of my home group, the Express Group. I'm going to go there just to, like, take some time out until the fact that it gets dark. So then I can leave the meeting and then go get shit-faced and like that. So I go to the meeting, I sit, I listen. The meeting ends, and I'm leaving. I'm done. Here's what happened. At the exact minute that I'm leaving the meeting, so if you talk about these powers or these divine moments, at the minute I'm leaving the meeting, the chairperson didn't show up for the second meeting, the 8:30 speaker meeting. And the person in the group asked Curtis to chair the meeting. Curtis, who, by the way, didn't take me home from the first meeting and is doing 15 years in prison. Not that that's related, but he picked up. He picked up, and it's a terrible thing, a terrible life he's had. My life has gone here, and he looks like he's 90. I visit him, and it's a tragedy. Booze and drugs, that's what happens. So they asked Curtis to chair the meeting. As I'm walking out to go get shit-faced, Curtis stops me, and he said, do me a favor, would you speak tonight? Now I have a quandary. I am going out, I got a pocket full of cash, and I'm going to get whacked. But they say you never say no to an AA request. Getting whacked, never say no. Anyway, I said okay. I spoke that night at the Express Group, it was by the airport. The only time, honestly, that I ever told an entirely fraudulent story. No, I mean, I could make stuff up and, you know, I mean, most of the stuff I think really happened probably never did. But the fact is, this night, I just invented stuff. I sat in the front of that room. I talked about God, what God has done. I mean, I don't know what I did. I went on like this Jimmy Swaggart role. I didn't even believe in anything. That God has taken me here and I'm... But I got to tell you something. Somewhere in the middle of that talk, the obsession to use left. So I went out afterwards, I went to eat, and then I went to my apartment. And I had been praying by this time. I had already bought a statue that I was praying to, but now I was past the statue, and I was praying in the shower. Like I was being frisked. You know, it was a comfortable position. And I was saying all of these stupid things, you know. But this particular night, August 28th, 1980, at about 11 or 12 o'clock when I got home, I was taking a shower and I said, God, about my father, thy will be done. I didn't give any suggestions. I said, thy will be done. I didn't say, find a cure for cancer, ease his pain. At that moment, I had totally let go of the results. That's the end result or goal in Alcoholics Anonymous, is totally to let go of the results. Because when we really come to believe, which we're going to hopefully do over the next couple of months, that's going to be the goal. That, you know what? The result is none of my business. All I'm responsible for is suiting up and showing up and giving whatever I can, little by slowly, to him. Whatever the him is, whoever it is. Nothing about religion. That's why it's God as we understood him. It's not about religion. Religion is not what this is about. This is about a power. Okay? So anyway, that night I'm in the shower and I simply said, God, about my father, thy will be done. 2 hours later, my mom, God rest her soul, called me up that my father had died. Now, I didn't jump for joy. I didn't say, wow, I found the connection. What I did tell you, at that minute, from August 28th, 1980, I realized there's a power that when sought, answers. In whatever honest, sincere way you seek, the answers are going to come. That was a direct answer. It was 2 hours. My dad's out of pain. He saw me sober 6 months. The last time I was up there, right before he died, I was in his bedroom and he was like half the weight and he looked at me and he says, you know, I was telling him 6 months worth of what I learned here. He says, look, I'm dying. I lived a good life. Are you still going to your meetings? In 6 months, he saw you guys did something to me that no drug program, no treatment center, no mental hospital, no psychiatrist, no psychologist, nothing was able to do for me in years what 6 months of you people had done in his eyes. He knows he died with me knowing I'm okay. He knows ifs, ands, or buts. And I've spent these last 30 plus years, almost 31 years, living into that legacy. Him knowing that I know, that he knows that I know. That man, I'm a power of example, an example of the power. Now we're going to talk about this little kid here, but before we do that, just if you're having a problem, no, because there's not enough time here to do too much of this raffle crap. Do the raffles at 7, okay? Really, I'm serious. Wherever the raffle guy is, I need an hour, okay? Anyway, so the reality is that if you're having trouble with the power, if you're having trouble with believing, in any level, because we come from dysfunctional families. Yeah, because you were in them. That's what made them dysfunctional. The reality. But, you know, forget about the inner child, the little children. Shoot the inner child. What I'm saying to you is right here and right now, I'm going to make it very simple to you. I'm not even going to ask the question if anyone understands electricity, because probably someone here will say yes. I don't. And I don't care to understand it. What I am going to tell you is when I go home tonight, I'm going to walk into my apartment and I'm going to look to my right and I'm going to turn this switch. When I turn that switch, I have come to believe that my house is going to be light. And I have come to believe that by turning that switch, my life is going to be simpler. I have come to believe that by turning that switch, I am going to be able to operate and be in full view and to see what I need to see. And I've also come to believe that if I don't turn that switch, my life is going to be very difficult. If I don't turn that switch, I'm not going to be able to function. I'm going to be stumbling and running into my furniture, into the tables. So the simplicity of coming to believe is just that. When you go home tonight, flip that switch. You don't understand that, neither do I. I don't understand that, but it makes my life simpler. I don't understand God. Makes my life simpler. So I keep it up. I'm stacking the deck. That's all I'm doing. I'm stacking the deck. I'm a hunch player. My whole life, I like to, you know, this thing's been working for 31 years, 1 month, and 2 days. Why would I stop now? Now let me tell you this. I'm going to finish up with this. And then next week we're going to do the second step again. Someone tonight, I was at dinner, he says, so how long do you take? 10 weeks? I guess Chris was in. I think sometimes 10 weeks, sometimes 20. It depends, because it depends how far back I get. But I'm backed up now. So here we go. But you're here. So. 1980, you got to understand. The Express Group was the young people's group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The reason, because we all took the express train here, like in New York, the express train, because we all did other substances. You know, gin, rum, heroin, and coke. That's how we got the express group. Okay, they just didn't advertise it that way, but that's what it was. Not, you know, making it up. That's what it was. Matter of fact, there's this Bill Wilson tape that I'm listening to right now. I think I should make like 300 copies of. Maybe sell them, I can pay my rent. No, but this tape, no kidding. He says in the tape that was made in 1950, he says, and you know what? If you're gambling or drugging or drinking, these steps are the answer for you. 1950. I mean, it was insane. I've listened to it 5 times so far. It's an incredible tape from 1950, the day Dr. Bob died. Anyway, so I'm in the Express Group, and I'm involved. It's my home group. I'm in the middle of the deal. This guy comes down, and he's 16 years old from Philadelphia. So that's a real young people. I mean, I'm 31, and I'm a young person, and he's 16. And we're in the same group at the same time. And we're both involved. Now, after a year or two, this guy, his name's Chris, and he leaves and he moves to L.A. He wants to become an actor. I mean, he was only 16, so now he's 18 with 2 years of sobriety. He can still do anything you want, but he's really involved in the program, which is proof that you can get sober at any age, by the way. Greatest commercial in the world. So now he's 18. He's in California, and we sort of lose touch with each other. Now let's fast forward. I mean, I know he's sober. I hear different things. Now we're going to fast forward. 2 years ago, I'm in New York City in my apartment. And I wake up 3 in the morning, and I go to my den, and I'm flashing TV things, TV channels. And all of a sudden, I look at the TV screen, and the guy's very funny that I'm watching on the screen. The only part that didn't fit is he's an Orthodox Jewish costume making jokes. Now, that just doesn't go hand in hand, at least from where I come from. They're just not like the happiest people you ever met. He's freaking black robes. And, you know, I mean, really, they're scary just looking at him. And one thing leads to another. I sit down. I'm watching the thing now. And he says, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. He says, and I didn't always look this way. And I got sober and clean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And my name's Chris Campbell. Well, I fell off the couch. It's 3:30 in the morning, 4 in the morning. I couldn't call Maureen yet. My wife was still asleep. And a couple other people that were still alive that remembered him. So I like freaked. So I tell this friend of mine, Stefan, who's living in New York, who moved to Israel. We get together that night, and I tell him that story. And he says, oh, that guy. He says, yeah, I go to AA meetings with him in Jerusalem. Now, here's what happened, just so you can follow this bouncing ball. He left Florida, was somehow, I mean, I don't want to get religious. It's not even religious. He was somehow attracted to Judaism, probably because of a chick, obviously. I mean, I'm not going to say it, but it's probably not too far from the truth. And so he becomes one level of Judaism, another. Anyway, the bottom line is, he now lives in Jerusalem. He's a professional comedian. And we went to see him on the bleakest street in the funniest freaking show we ever saw. I took my wife and people from out east. It was incredible. And what does he tell in this show? He tells the story of how he can be an alcoholic and a drug addict from an Irish Catholic family in Philadelphia. Get sober in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and now be an Orthodox Jew in Jerusalem. So if that doesn't help you come to believe, me looking at him right here, I am continuing to come to believe. And that's what happens. We continue to come to believe every single day. Something happens to reiterate for me the power of the power. You know, in this 5th chapter that we read at every meeting, it says something very important. We beg of you. Let me tell you something. If these guys 70 years ago were begging of me, I should pay attention. What are they begging? They're begging me to feel this on Thera from the very start. I want this deal. I want all of it. And Ray Allen used to always say to me, he used to say, Paul, you're feeling good. And I've had a beautifully blessed sobriety with periods of real trauma. Okay? I mean, seriously, you'll hear about that in the next 10 weeks. I mean, I've been way here, and then when I'm not here, I am there. And those times not there, I wouldn't think about using it. I thought about killing myself sober, because that's my default mechanism. And a lot of people have done that. Okay, and hopefully in the next 10 weeks I won't think of it, but you don't know. If I do, I'll still be up here. The reality is you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. Mad Glader said you come to this joint. Mad Glader said you get a sponsor that you pour your heart out to. And Ray Allen always said to me, you got a seat? You good? Ray Allen always said to me, you're feeling great, right? I said, I feel it unbelievable. It's incredible. He says, well, Paul, let me tell you something. You've only got the tip of the iceberg. And an iceberg is mostly underwater. He says, there's no end to what's going to happen to you. There's no end to the good. He says, so you just got to keep showing up, keep giving it away, because the more you give, the more you get. And what you try to keep to yourself, you lose, because it's in the giving that it reproduces. A friend of mine in Long Island, an old time, he's got 40-something years, he sent me a tape the other day, and I was just listening to it today. And he says, you know, I'm going to be a big book thumper now. Now, I know that Henry's not a big book thumper. So I'm listening to the tape. He says, I'm going to be a big book thumper. And he says, and here's what it is. He opens it up, and he says, page 88. It says, it works. It really does. Big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he put down the book. He says, why would I need to thump any further? It works. It really does. What's happening here tonight proves to me it works. It really does. So all I'm going to suggest to you is when you go home tonight, just say thanks. We'll see you next week. God bless you. I don't know if that was on. Yeah.